try CarolinaNeurosurgery.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's no secret the United States must catch up on both educating young people in the field of science, but also lighting a fire under them to become interested in it. For the next several weeks, UNC Charlotte is helping in that effort with their Science and Technology Expo and, of course, the North Carolina Science it's not a fair, but we'll get the title right later on. We'll find out more about that and the title later in the program. And while the university is focusing on science, CPCC is concentrating on the arts. Ron Rash is a North Carolina native and New York Times best-selling writer. He writes novels, short stories, and poetry. And now, one of his novels is about to become a Hollywood movie starring Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence. Mr. Rash is in town to participate in CPCC's Sensoria Festival. He'll be speaking twice today at 11 a.m. in Central Piedmont's Halton Theater and again tonight at 7:30 in Pease Auditorium. Both events are free and open to the public, but then so is this program. And Ron Rash joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Welcome to Charlotte. You are, where do you live now in North Carolina?
I live outside of Silva. I teach at Western Carolina University.
And have you always lived in that part of the world?
I have. Actually, between here and Asheville. I grew up in Boiling Springs, so not too far from here.
And you teach at Western Carolina.
I do.
Not only we hear a lot of stories from people who say, well, I'm the first college graduate in my family. But you're not only a college graduate, you teach at a college. And you come from a family where your grandfather used to read you books, but he was illiterate. That seems like a far amount of territory to travel in two generations.
It was, it's pretty amazing just what my parents were able to do. My mother coming off a farm in Watauga County, and my father's family come from Buncombe County down to work in the textile mills, and my grandfather could not read or write. My grandmother had gone into the mills at 14, and yet they raised a son who was able to go to school, go to night class, get a GED first, get night classes, take night classes after working a shift at the mill, eventually becoming a professor at Gardner-Webb.
So you got a GED?
He did.
Oh, he did?
Yeah,
he did.
Okay. Yeah.
And your grandfather, I said, he used to read you stories, but he couldn't read, so he just opened the book and what, made up the stories?
Right, yeah. It's one of the most vivid memories of my childhood. My mother bought me a copy of The Cat in the Hat, and she'd read it to me probably 20 or 30 times. And one weekend, we were at my grandparents', and my mother was busy and my father was busy. And so I asked my grandfather to read it, and he put me on his lap and opened up the book. And suddenly this story I thought I knew was very different.
Mm.
The cat was getting into a lot more trouble than he had when my mother read it.
And not rhyming.
And not rhyming, that's right. And even more amazing was the next time I asked him to read it, it was different as well. And so it turned out that I did not know it at the time. My grandfather could not read or write, but as a I've said, he taught me how to use my imagination.
I was going to say, first of all, it's very brave for somebody to do that. But secondly, he had to make all that stuff up, I guess, based on the pictures in the book. Is that where you get your imagination? Is that where it started for you?
I think in some ways it probably did. That was something that was very important because it made words magical.
Yeah.
One of the great disappointments of my life was when I couldn't make my words do that. You know, they would only stay in the same place once I started learning how to read.
Mm-hmm. But that gave you, I would think, the understanding that you are free to create details, to make things up, to embellish on stories that you already know.
Absolutely.
Hmm. You are a teacher now, and you taught composition, I believe, at a technical college for years before you officially became a writer. And you're not only a writer, you're a successful writer with about 9 books to your credit and one about to be made into a movie. And you still teach.
I do.
Why?
I love teaching, and I come from a family of teachers. As I said, my father ended up teaching at Gardner-Webb, and my mother was an elementary school teacher. And I think it's a calling, and I think it's so important. And my teachers have been so important to me, and you hope that you are doing something that will help impact younger people's lives in a positive way.
So when you were younger, when you were 18, 19, 20, 21, and you were in college, and thinking about what's life going to hold in store for me. Was being a writer one of the things you thought about, or was being a teacher the focus at the time?
Well, actually, neither one. I was an atrocious student, and I actually failed the sixth grade and had to go to summer school. And I didn't do much better in high school. I was running track, and that was, I actually went to college on track scholarship. And I think what it did show was that I tended to be pretty obsessive. I mean, if I was into track, I was into track totally. And then when I was about 24, I pulled a hamstring. Suddenly, I had to put all that energy into something else, and I put it into writing. And I'd always loved to read, so, I mean, I think the transition was pretty natural.
When did you think, I could do this. I could be a professional at this. I could make some money. Maybe not. I wouldn't become rich or famous, but I could make some money at this.
Well, I didn't know for a long time. I when I was in my early 20s and I started writing, and as I got into my later 20s and became very serious, that was one of the scariest aspects of it was, am I good enough to do this? And when I was in my late 20s, I really hadn't written anything, that was any good. And I was very discouraged. I put in hour after hour, and I made a decision. I said, the decision was, would you rather live your life and not know if you could do it, or would you rather risk failing? And I felt like I'd rather risk failing and at least know that I'd really committed myself to it.
But you just said that you'd written a bunch of stuff that was not really very good. So what flipped the switch? How did you get to be very good? Because you obviously are very good.
I think it was just a matter of Malcolm Gladwell has a 5,000-hour rule. I think it was just a matter of putting in enough time to really the same as if you were going to be a really good guitarist. There's a lot of a period of time where you're struggling, you're learning how to do your craft. And I think finally when I got into my late 20s, about 29, 28, I started to realize for the first time, well, this is my voice. This is not derivative of Hemingway or Faulkner. And this is not bad. I could look at it and go back and reread it. But it was very gradual. And I think writers, every time I start another project, I'm filled with self-doubt. Can I do this again?
And writing is a very solitary effort. So I'm just curious about when you read your own work, particularly in the beginnings, before you had been published, before you had been awarded all these awards you've gotten over your career, before Hollywood called and said, we'd like to make this novel into a movie. And you looked at your work and you said, this is pretty good. How did you have enough confidence in yourself to really know it was pretty good? How could you step back from what you had slaved over and analyze it the same way you might analyze a Faulkner novel?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I could look at it, mainly because I knew it was different from what I'd been doing before. I could just tell that I'd kind of broken through to a voice, as I said, that I felt like was my own and no one else's. And just that, I'd read enough. I've always been a voracious reader, that I felt like I was a pretty good judge of what was good and what wasn't. And I could look at my own work and say, well, this is pretty good.
Why do you write? What drives you to tell stories?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I think part of it is due to, I feel an obligation because of what my grandparents and parents went through to put me in a position where I could do this. And a lot of my work honors my family or the region I come from particularly. That's part of it. And I think it's my sensibility. I've always been very solitary. As a child, I was very comfortable, being by myself. I mean, I can remember when I was 10, 12 years old, I would be on my grandmother's farm, and I'd go off at 8 o'clock in the morning and wouldn't come back to 4 or 5. I mean, you can't imagine that today, that a child could do that. But I've just always been comfortable in solitude, and I think that you have to be a writer, obviously.
I've had so many guests tell me that they used to go off and be by themselves all day or go off with their friends and play all day and then come back at 5 o'clock and no one thought anything about it and that today you couldn't do it. And I'm wondering if you think that that will change people like you in the future. If you can't go off and explore the world unfettered, if you're on a leash, essentially, all the time, will that diminish a person's ability to become a writer in the future?
I would say not only a writer, but a person who's a very thoughtful, a thinker, a person who can understand complexity. Because I think one thing that's very interesting is what we find out about multitasking now is that you're not really being very effective.
You can't do it. It's not possible.
Yes. Right. And I think it's that kind of deep reflection that you get in solitude that allows you to really kind of free yourself from the clutter and really center on something and think about in a depth, you know, great depth.
Our guest today is New York Times bestselling author Ron Rash. His newest book is called Nothing Gold Can Stay. His book, Serena, a novel, is being turned into a Hollywood movie, which we'll talk about. You told NPR Scott Simon that you began thinking in earnest about becoming a writer when at 15 you read Crime and Punishment. I can't think of many 15-year-olds who read that book. But you said, for you it was, and I love this, what you said, the first time that you hadn't just entered a book, it had entered you. And I think everybody who reads at all has experienced, at the very end of the book, they mourn the loss of the inner life that this book has created in them. Is that what your goal is when you sit down to write, to make that happen for the reader?
That's my hope. It's my hope. And because, as I say, that was such an amazing moment. I was also making a D in biology while that was going on because I was on the back row reading that book, I might add. But
it paid off.
Yeah, well, I guess so. For a while, the jury was out on that. But, I think that, to me, that's just such an amazing experience. We can enter a book so intently, or the book allows us to enter and to enter us at the same time, that it's a transcendent experience. And there have been, you know, a number of books that have done that for me, but certainly Crime and Punishment was the first time that I sensed that. And to me, reading a book like that with great attentiveness is the ultimate act of interaction. It's almost like communion, where you bring everything that you are into the book and you merge with the sensibility of the author. Because if you think about it, without the participation of the reader, all the writer's giving on one level is splotches of ink.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the reader who comes to it, takes those splotches of ink, those words, and then is able to envision them, to feel them, to be moved, and, you know, very often to tears sometimes, or to laughter. And to me, that's an amazingly interactive experience.
And we create whatever you've put on the page. We extrapolate from that ink
right.
and paper a world that doesn't exist.
Right.
And our vision of what you created might be different from your vision of what
right.
you created. And that's about to happen for you. You don't know what's going on in the minds of readers reading your work, but you're about to find out what's going on in the minds of people who have read Serena and now want to make it into a Hollywood film. Does that scare you in any way? Because they're taking your baby now and making it into something that it wasn't.
Yeah. Well, I think another writer a few years ago said something that makes sense to me. He said, somebody had asked him, are you worried about what, you know, they're going to do to your book? That's, and he said, no, because they will not change a single word of my book. And I think that's a good way to, you know, to look at it. And I see it simply as a translation. You're taken into another medium, another art form, and I you can't expect it to be the same. You can't expect obviously all of the novel to be to be incorporated into a 2-hour movie.
Right.
And it's also the someone else's artistic vision. So that's the way I want to view it.
Ron Rash, his latest book is called Nothing Gold Can Stay. It's a collection of short stories. I'm going to talk about why you write in so many different formats, short stories, novels, poems, when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, presenting the new 2013 Subaru models, including the XV Crosstrek, an all-wheel drive crossover built for all-terrain and fuel efficiency. More information at TyndallSubaru.com. Last year, North Carolina voters passed a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage and civil unions. California voters outlawed gay marriage through Proposition 8, but the Supreme Court has taken up the issue, as well as the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And while we wait on a decision from the Supreme Court on that, some activists out there are still working to change the situation, and we'll talk to some of them tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on the investigation into the deadly Boston explosions and new questions on limits of security.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Ron Rash, New York Times best-selling author, poet, short story writer. Nothing Gold Can Stay is the name of his latest book. I have to correct myself. He's speaking today at CPCC's Halton Theater at 10:30, not 11, 10:30. And again tonight at 7:30 in Pease Auditorium, which is right across the street. Once you became a New York Times best-selling author, once you were given an award for short story writing and became a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award and won a few O. Henry prizes, did the writing become more or less difficult? Because now you have a reputation. Now you have to be as good as the last book and hopefully better. What does that do up in here while you're sitting there writing?
I've tried to avoid that, at least consciously, and I the way I go into it is that with everything I write, I mean, I know that, for instance, some stories, some books, some novels are going to be better than others. I mean, that's just the nature of it, that they're not always going to be the same. But I go in, and I take what I've got, the story I've got, and I do the very best I can, and I feel like if I've done the best I can with this story, you know, that's all I can do. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's up to the reader to decide, you know, is this book better than the last one? But the one thing I don't want to do is repeat myself. So if someone wants me to write another Serena, mm-hmm. I'm not going to consciously do that. I'm going to try to write a story that's new.
You're also a teacher, and you teach writing.
Yes.
Does that put pressure on you? Because your students have access to your writing.
Well, you know, I think that's only fair. I'm reading their work and commenting on it, but I think in a way it's good because they know that the same struggles they're going through mm-hmm. when they write for our class, I'm going through every day as well, and we talk about that. And I bring in my drafts, and I never read to them from my work, but I might bring in a draft where I've worked one page 30 times, and just to show them, you know, it's not easy for me either.
Talk about that. That seems terribly tedious to rework something you've written 30 times. Most people couldn't get beyond the second revision.
Well, that's where the magic is. That's where the phrase or the image that the reader can't get away from, that comes sometimes from draft after draft, having it almost right, but then not quite right. And as I go through each draft, I'm very often, particularly when I get to the late drafts, I'm listening or I'm looking for certain things. As a matter of fact, when I get to my last draft, all I'm listening to is the way that vowels and consonants rub against each other.
Really?
Which syllables are stressed. And the key is that you don't want the reader to necessarily notice that, but what you do want the reader to do is feel like this is a clean sentence. There's something going on here that my ear is hearing.
I mean, does that come from being a poet as well? Because poetry is meant to be read out loud. Novels, you don't generally read out loud.
Yeah. Well, true, but I would argue even if the reader is reading silently, he or she hears the rhythms. And as I say, I think it's just another bonus to the story. I mean, there are writers such as Cormac McCarthy, whom I read just for their language. I can pick up their book at any page and just start reading, just the pleasure of the language alone.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, when you're writing character dialogue, it has to be in the language of the character and in the character of the character and in the rhythm of the character. So you're doing all these different, I guess, mental juggling acts in your head to make this happen.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the fun part. In a way, it's like I'm taking a vacation from myself. It's very similar to being a method actor, I think. You become someone else.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, and I want you to read a part of a story here from the last. The newest book is called Nothing Gold Can Stay. It's a collection of short stories, and it takes the reader up to Appalachia from the Civil War through the present day. And so it's full of different situations, different time, different people, different sensibilities. and yet you craft this world that's not yours, and it's full of minute detail. So the world is almost complete. The reader doesn't really have to do very much work except read, and it just explodes in their head. So would you read a part of the last story, which is called 3 a.m., and the stars were out.
Yeah. This is a story about a veterinarian, an older man in his early 80s. And this is in the western North Carolina mountains. And he's gone out on a late night call, a 3 a.m. call, to an old friend's house, a guy he grew up with. And they're going to deliver, or hope to deliver, a calf. And so he shows up there, and he's meeting his friend Darnell in the barn. The lantern hung just inside the barn mouth, offering a thin apron of light to help Carson make his way. He took slow, careful steps so as not to trip on old milking traces. Inside, it took a few moments to adjust to the barn's starless dark. Near the back stall, the cow lay on the straw floor. Darnell kneeled beside her, one hand stroking her flank. A stainless steel bucket was close by, already filled with water. Beside it, rags and a frayed bedsheet. Darnell's shotgun, not his rifle, leaned across a stall door. "How long?" Carson asked. 3 hours. Carson set the bags down and checked the cow's gums, then placed the stethoscope silver bell against the flank before pulling on a shoulder glove. "I think it's breached," Darnell said. Carson lubed the glove, slid his hand and forearm inside, felt a bent leg, then a shoulder, another leg, and finally the head. He slipped a finger inside the mouth and felt a suckle. Life stubbornly held on. Maybe he wouldn't have to pull the calf one piece at a time. At least a chance. Carson spread the tarp on the barn floor, set out what he'd need while Darnell retrieved the lantern and set it beside Carson. Inside the lantern's low light, the world shrank to a circle of straw. Within it, two old men, a cow, and though curtained, a calf. Carson did a quick swab and pushed in the needle, waited for the lidocaine to ease the contractions. Darnell still stroked the cow's flank. As a young vet, Carson had quickly learned there were some men and women, good people otherwise, who'd let a lame calf linger days, not bothering to end its misery. They did the same with a sheep with black leg. Never Darnell, though. Because he'd witnessed enough suffering in Korea not to wish it on man or animal was what some folks would think. But Carson knew it to be as much Darnell's innate decency. "Why the shotgun?" Carson asked. "Coyotes. I've not heard any of late, but this is the sort of thing to draw them." Darnell nodded at the calf jack. "Figure you'll have to use it?" "I'm going to try not to." The cow's abdomen relaxed and the round eyes calmed. Somewhere in the loft, a swallow stirred. Then the barn was silent and the lantern's light seemed to soften. The calf waited in its deeper darkness for Carson to birth it whole and alive, or dead and in pieces. Carson lubed his hand, no glove now, and slid it inside, pushed the calf as far back as he could, making space. Sweat trickled down his forehead, his eyes closed now to better imagine the calf's body. He found the snout, tugged it forward a bit, then back, then to one side, then another. Carson's heart banged his panting chest like a quickening hammer. The muscles in his neck and shoulder burned. He stopped for a minute, his arms still inside as he caught his breath. "What do you think?" Darnell asked. "Maybe," Carson answered. Half an hour passed before he got the head aligned. Darnell gave him a wet hand cloth, and Carson wiped the sweat off his face and neck. He rested a little while longer before nodding at the tarp. "Okay, let's get that leg." Darnell hooked the OB chain to the handle and gave the other end to Carson, who looped the chain around a front leg. Darnell gripped the handle and dug his boot heels into the barn floor. "Okay," Carson said, his hand on the calf's leg. The chain slowly tightened. Carson bent the foreleg to ensure the hoof didn't rake the uterine wall. Darnell did the hard work now, grunting as his muscles strained. They spoke little, Carson nodding left or right when needed. Minutes passed as the leg gave and caught, like cracking a safe. That's how Carson thought of it, finding the combination that made the last tumbler fall into place. It felt like that, the womb swinging open and the calf withdrawn. There were times he could almost hear the click.
Ron Rash, reading from a story called 3 A.M. and the Stars Were Out from his latest book of short stories, Nothing Gold Can Stay. We didn't hear the whole story, obviously, but these are longtime friends. Carson is the vet, and Darnell is the gentleman with the cow who's in trouble. And they date their friendship back to their time in Korea, when they made a pact to always be there for each other. And even though Carson is retired as a vet, he still services Darnell's animals because they made that pact to be together. So you bring some of their youth into the story. You bring veterinary medicine and farming and small-town life into the story. You bring their late wives into the story. And each detail is alive enough to let us know what these guys are thinking and feeling and experiencing. Would this have been, would a chapter in a novel about these men or about Carson have been as full of detail as these pages are because it's a short story?
I would say probably not. I think what makes short stories unique is that you attempt to, very often in just a single scene, embody all that a character has been and all that a character will be. I mean, that the reader goes into this story, sees this brief moment in these two men's lives, and if the story is good enough, the reader is satisfied. The reader feels like, well, I don't need to know anything else about these men. That, I mean, obviously, there is more to be told of their lives, but at the same time, that you feel like their essence has been revealed in this moment.
And perhaps this moment is a particularly good moment in their life, and the rest of it is just humdrum?
Yeah, and that's the other thing. I mean, that's part of what, you know, somebody one time asked, well, you know, why is there so much conflict, sometimes violence in fiction? And it's because it's the dramatic moment that draws us, but not just that it titillates, but it also is when we really reveal who we are as human beings. The mask are dropped in those dramatic moments. Right.
You're a novelist. You write short stories. You're a poet. And all of these efforts are published. How were you able to break out of being pigeonholed by publishers or readers, for that matter?
Well, you hope that what you write, while it's very much of a place, a particular place, and everything I've written has been in the Western Carolinas, based there, that the reader,
and that was a decision on you.
Oh yeah, very conscious decision, because the writers that I admire, and I'm not putting myself in their league, believe me, but Faulkner, O'Connor, James Joyce, these are writers who have found the universal in a particular place, and that's what I think a writer who sometimes is called regional. That term I'm wary of sometimes, because I think it implies that you're just, you know, what you're writing about is only relevant to this particular place. But what Eudora Welty once said, one place understood helps us understand all other places better. Mm. And that's kind of it is my belief.
So getting back to the pigeonhole nature, how have you managed to not be pigeonholed?
I think because I've been very fortunate in that the work has done well, particularly overseas. You know, I'm actually getting ready to go over to Ireland and England next week. I recently came back from Denmark and Brussels, and I've gotten really good receptions outside the South, outside the United States, and I would like to think that part of that is not just that I'm writing about the American South, but that the people who read the stories recognize, well, these people speak differently. They're different culture in some ways, but ultimately their concerns are the concerns of everyone.
Mm-hmm. What attracts you to one form over the other? I mean, this could have been a novel about Carson or Darnell, but you chose to make it a short story. Why?
Very often it's the story or the image that dictates that to me. I mean, very often when I first start out, I don't know. I might think it's going, actually my first novel started off as a 14-line poem, and I felt like, well, I don't think I've quite said what I wanted to say. Then I wrote a short story of about 15 pages, and So, you know, it just, sometimes it just, whether it continues to open up or sometimes contract. I mean, I've had what I thought might be a story end up as a maybe a 20-line poem.
You told someone that the first, I think it's one of the early stories in this book, The Trustee, which is about a chain gang worker going to get water for the chain gang, and he meets with this farmer's wife in the middle of nowhere in a ramshackle shack in the 1930s, I guess, and that started for you as an image of a man on a chain gang walking down the road with buckets. Where did that image come from?
Well, that's the mystery. When I wrote Serena, my novel, that novel began with just a single image of a woman on horseback. And where the image comes from, you just hope they keep coming. I mean, it's you know, the more I write, the more mysterious it is. Particularly, you know, what is it that happens that causes a story to suddenly come to a writer? I don't know.
Serena is an interesting book, an interesting story. It's about to be made into this movie that we talked about with Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper, which I believe is due out in December. They've already begun shooting it in.
Oh, they finished it.
Yeah. And they shot it. Where did they shoot it?
Czech Republic.
Czech Republic, which I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there was another writer who writes about Appalachia, and they shot his film in the Czech Republic. I don't know what it is about the Czech Republic and the Appalachian Mountains, but anyway. Serena is Jennifer Lawrence's character's name. And in the story, if I understand this correctly, she is the equal to any man in the North Carolina mountains of 1929 and has a mind bent on jealous retribution. Serene is something she is not. So was the name Serena deliberate?
Oh, very deliberate, yeah. And I wanted to actually work in three ways because she is – anything but serene. She's obviously, I mean, she's capable of great malice and following through on it. But she's, there is at the end, you know, in a way, there is a kind of serenity to her in the sense that she's rarely unruffled. She's rarely ruffled. I mean, she is able to kind of think through things in a very sometimes frighteningly logical way. And also I wanted an implication of Selena, the goddess of the moon. So, you know, you, as a writer, sometimes you it's fun to play with names and you don't want it to be heavy-handed, but at the same time you do want, you know, if the name can resonate. And also it would be exotic. She comes from outside of Western North Carolina. So that, to me, that would be an exotic name.
That novel, Serena, has been described as one of the greatest American novels of recent memory. Wow.
Well, I didn't say it.
No, you didn't say it. No, but it's been described by people who know, people who write. Your character, Carson, I only have 30 seconds, likes his solitude. He likes being alone and thinking, as you do too. And I don't believe any other writer I've spoken to has chosen to write in front of a fire. When you do that, do you sit behind a desk? Do you write longhand on a pad of paper? How do you do it? Quickly.
I have a computer, and I have a legal pad, and sometimes I have two dogs.
Ron Rash, New York Times bestselling author, author of Nothing Gold Can Stay, speaking at 10:30 and 7:30 at CPCC, at the Halton at 10:30, 7:30 tonight at Pease Auditorium. Thanks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Horak Talley, lawyers who negotiate to resolve disputes, handle complex business litigation, and protect clients' interests in court. Horak Talley, attorneys who get things done. And Children's Theater of Charlotte presenting Pinkalicious, the musical with Broadway-style show tunes, dancing cupcakes, and a sparkling story for boys and girls now through May 5th. Tickets available at ctcharlotte.org. The latest on the investigation into the deadly Boston explosions and new questions on the limits of security. That is the topic of the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And when we come back, the North Carolina Science Festival and the UNC Charlotte Science and Technology Expo. All about that in a moment.
PRI's The World brings you voices from around the globe.
In a place like a refugee camp, $1 an hour for work in an air-conditioned computer lab is possibly the best job that you could ever come upon.
It's your daily source for international news and a gateway to cultures beyond our borders. I'm Marco Werman. Join me right here for the next edition of The World. weekday afternoons at 3 on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. If we are to remain competitive, indeed, if the United States is to maintain its supremacy in technology and innovation, more young people must be turned on by and go into science. For the next several weeks, UNC Charlotte is doing its part to both celebrate the achievements of those who have already gotten the science bug and to light a fire under those who might if only they saw how neat it is. They are sponsoring the North Carolina Science Festival, known to some, and I'm going to get this completely wrong, we'll correct it in a second, known to some as the UNC Charlotte Science and Technology Expo, and here to tell us what visitors can expect is Jonathan Frederick, director of the North Carolina Science Festival. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Also with us is Catherine Qualtrough. I got your name wrong again.
Catherine Qualtrough.
Qualtrough, okay. Observatory Director and Lab Manager at UNC Charlotte. And let's clean up something here because I couldn't make hide nor hair of it yesterday when I was trying to get ready for this. The North Carolina Science Festival is the umbrella under which the Science and Technology Expo exists. Is that correct?
Yeah, the big circus tent under which we kind of put that all over the state, and we have hundreds of events happening, one of which is the amazing UNC Charlotte Science and Technology Expo.
And this is the second year that the Science and Technology
Expo? Yes, it is. UNC Charlotte, this is our second year running the Science and Technology Expo Day, which is this Sunday, the 21st. Mm-hmm. So we're really lucky to be involved with the NC Science Festival and be an official event.
New Zealand or Australia?
New Zealand.
New Zealand, okay. I knew you were from Kannapolis.
Close, yes.
And this is taking place, as you said, all over the state. It's been underway for the whole month of April so far. So we're coming into the midsection of all this. This must be an enormous undertaking. Who do you involve in all this around the state?
Yeah, we're based out of Moorhead Planetarium on UNC Chapel Hill's campus, but we could not do this without about 250 to 300 partners all over the state, ranging from universities, libraries, museums. It's pretty incredible what all these folks do to celebrate science with
us. And is all this aimed at young people, at children, no?
It's predominantly we like to aim it at children because we want to spark that curiosity and passion in children in particular so that we can advance STEM.
STEM is science, technology, engineering,
and
mathematics.
Math. Yes. So we want to encourage children to be more passionate and curious about this, but also it's equally interesting and important for adults.
Why aren't they children? Why aren't they more? They live in an unprecedented time. Kids today live in a time where people have never been surrounded by more products of science. And by that I mean computers and iPhones and iPads and television sets and the internet and you name something, name anything, any appliance in the kitchen. why aren't they just exploding with curiosity about how all this stuff works and what might be next?
I think that they are, actually, to be honest. Children, everyone's naturally curious. Humans are meant to learn. We're wired to do it. My niece just the other day picked up a magazine and slid her finger across a picture because she thought it was a broken iPad. I mean, their technology and everything that's happening around us is very, very exciting to children. I think what we want to do, though, is keep that spark going. We find there's a lot of data that shows when people opt out of science or become uncomfortable with science. We want to make sure that everyone is comfortable because it is a fact of our world that we're getting more connected. We're going to need science to help us solve a lot of our problems.
Do either of you understand? Are you both in the classroom? Are you both teachers?
I am a teacher, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you know what it is that turns some kids off, where you lose them when they disengage?
Well, there are statistics saying that we're losing children at the kind of middle school level. A statistic that I just read actually was about 60% of high school freshmen who enter wanting to pursue STEM careers, perhaps. By the time they graduate high school, they don't want to do that anymore.
Why?
That's a good question. I mean, perhaps it's the way we're teaching it. Perhaps, you know, they're not getting to see the fun parts of science, how the scientific method works. They're thinking that science is learning facts by rote, which isn't fun for most people. So we need
to. It also involves lots of math.
Exactly. That's another thing.
You know, I talked to somebody about this a couple of years ago, and maybe we're our own worst enemy because we give out the vibe that math is hard. Well, if it's hard, I'm going to do it. Whereas we don't say how difficult language is. Language is difficult, but everybody speaks. So are we turning kids off by saying, ooh, this is hard, and well, I don't want to do it then?
I think that's possible, and I think that's one of the reasons why we decided to start this science festival, is that we wanted people who love science to be involved, but we also wanted people who kind of think that math, technology, engineering are all boring or hard topics. We ask them, do you like math? And they say, no. Well, the science festival is for you because we find innovative ways to teach these things. An example would be like a science fair you mentioned earlier. You know, the standard science fair model is you have a table placard and someone stands there and the scientists come around and the student explains their research. For a program like a science festival, we may want to flip that on its head and have the scientists stand there at a placard and explain their research to children and let the children decide which scientist was the most interesting, which mathematician was the most imaginative, and maybe there's an award for the scientist who communicated the best, because we want to put the onus on everybody to get more comfortable with science.
Yeah. Some of the ways you're doing this sound really interesting. You run the gamut from serious science and how it's used to keep a city running smoothly, which we can talk about, to how many superheroes in the comic book world derive their superpowers from science, technology, and engineering. Now, if you snag a comic book reader and get him or her interested in science, do you have a leg up? Because it seems to me that kids who are really imaginative and really get turned on by superheroes and the things that they can do and the ways that they can operate in the world, they see practical application already for things that don't exist in some cases.
It's true. It's a great avenue. You know, children being interested in science fiction and coming to these events and saying, well, could this happen? Could we do this? And a lot of our scientific ideas now are quite similar to what you might see in these superhero books. You know, we had a guest lecture, or one of our lectures series, about invisibility, for instance. So that's kind of fascinating.
Story of my life, by the way.
So, yeah, that was an amazing talk about the physics of invisibility, and you know, children thinking, oh, so what can we do? What are these?
Isn't it true that they're just a couple of years away from inventing the Harry Potter invisibility cloak?
Yeah,
essentially.
If you look at DARPA, I lost a few hours at work one day looking at DARPA's the Pentagon's Defense Research Wing, their website, and if you look at what the projects they're working on, it's straight out of comic books. It's like scaling walls. It's teaching. It's developing invisibility cloaks. I mean, it is comic book science that is coming to life.
And they've already developed a sound wave weapon where they aim the sound wave gun at you and you simply can't move. It doesn't kill you. It doesn't hurt you. You just can't move as long as it's aimed at you. You didn't know about this? This was on 60 Minutes.
Worst concert ever.
We had a guest on a couple of years ago who wrote a book. I think it was based on Chapel Hill. I think he did a lot of research in Chapel Hill where he went and he wanted to know how everything that came into his house, the water, the electricity, how everything that went out of his house, the trash, the sewage, etc., how that happened in that town. And you're doing this as a display, how science is put together to make a city work.
Yeah, we've been blown away by the participation of the Charlotte region, particularly the city of Kannapolis. I have to give a nod to. They do some incredible stuff. And yeah, they're doing some programming with a lot of their public utility offices about the STEM that goes into running a city. And it's becoming an increasingly important issue as we want to become more sustainable.
This sounds like a science fair to me on steroids.
It really is. Our Sunday event, our expo, is an amazing, amazing fun event. I mean, we're going to be having combustion chemistry, blowing up hydrogen. We've got robots. We've got a NASCAR for motorsports. You know, we run the gamut from astronomy right through to geology.
What kind of robots do you have?
So we're actually working with NC First Robotics, which is a nonprofit, who'll be showing off some of their Lego robots that were designed by high school students.
Lego robots?
Yeah.
Do they move? Do they do
things? They do, I believe.
Why are they made out of Legos? That seems to be
fairly
static. I think
it's one of the it's one of the options. So there is a competition where they make robots out of varying materials. But this is a great way for your students to take a problem and solve it using technology that we have now.
You're also going to be showing kids how to build their own solar cell using juice from blackberries. You're calling this juice from juice.
Indeed. That's a great demonstration.
Why
from
blackberries?
Chemistry. Blackberries, because they absorb sunlight and light, and we can use that to create an electrical current
in
a solar
cell. Is that what makes it solar?
Yes.
Could you have used orange juice?
I think they use blackberries because they're so pigmented and they absorb
more light. So the light is actually going into the blackberry.
So yes,
as you're generating the current.
Yes, and then you generate a current using some semiconductor material.
So if you take the light source away, does the current stop?
Yes.
Can you do it with a grape?
I'm not totally. I think you would be able to.
Is there a practical application? Are we going to see a bunch of blackberry farms generating electric power?
Well, I think
watch out.
Yeah, we're probably not generating a lot of electricity this way, but it's a great way for kids to see. This is a simple demonstration of something that has huge implications and applications in our world. Mm-hmm. You know, solar cells becoming more energy efficient is vital.
And the university's College of Computing and Informatics is displaying something that's really kind of interesting. I don't know what it's about, but you're going to tell me now. Virtual human, virtual human who will respond to questions. How is this different from Siri?
Well, you'll actually be able to see this virtual human. Virtual human's name is Charlotte, and you'll be able to ask her a series of questions, and she'll be able to respond to those.
Any questions or a series of pre-programmed questions?
Yeah, they have to be certain questions. Mm-hmm. But this was designed by students at UNC Charlotte. So really innovative and just fascinating.
And these students designed this for what purpose?
To work on computing and informatics and how we interact with computers and database. Mm.
The Science Festival, the North Carolina Science Festival, which has been going on all month and will now go on here through the 21st of April, culminating with the UNC Charlotte Science and Technology Expo. Is it the same all over the state, or do you capitalize on the specialization of certain areas like the tech area up in Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill? How does it work?
Yeah, we like to let the region show off their strengths. So we tend to convene meetings and listen and hear what all the amazing resources that are going on. And so we let folks decide what they want to do. And for example, the UNC Research Nutrition Research Institute is helping us with an event. You mentioned earlier, are the events just for children? We do certainly focus on families, but we recognize that there are grandparents and parents and families, college students. Alton Brown is coming this Saturday to Charlotte's Night Theater to talk about the science of cooking and teach us a little bit about kitchen chemistry. That was basically born out of a discussion with some nutrition folks in the Kannapolis area. Mm.
He's from the Food Network's show Good Eats, Alton Brown is. And he's doing this tonight, as a matter of fact, in Durham. So he's
tomorrow night. Yeah.
Tomorrow night. So he's traveling around the state doing this cooking chemistry demonstration. Do you know what he's going to be talking about or how it works?
Yeah, they've asked us to not give everything away,
right.
But he did say that he will be making a little bit of a mess and that there'll be some liquid nitrogen involved.
Do the people of the Night Theater know this?
Just to clarify, I think that's Friday night that he's speaking.
It's April 20th, whatever night that is. I think it's April 20th. you're also doing something at the Science and Technology Expo, the Future Oceans Time Machine. This is a biology demonstration. What will they be demonstrating?
They'll be showing us what happens when they put CO2, so carbon dioxide, into the oceans. So basically simulating what will happen with climate change, how it will affect marine life and shellfish, and how we can measure the impacts of global warming or climate change on those marine species.
Now, this is the intersection of science and politics, because there are a lot of people who are climate change deniers and just don't believe it, or they don't believe that humans have caused it, or they don't believe that there's anything we can do about it, or a combination of all three. So how do you approach this as scientists and educators in the classroom?
Well, we hope that we can change that perception. We have a lot of data to show that climate change is real. And that's something that we need people to be able to see, and demonstrations like this and talking to the scientists that are working on this and publishing papers helps the public to see that it is real and that this is happening.
You're also bringing scientists of great accomplishment to talk to people on a human level in a way that they can understand. We had one of your speakers on this program last week, Dr. Sean Connell, who is a theoretical physicist. You're also having Daniel Janes, a professor of bioinformatics and genomics, talking about weather maps for infectious disease tonight at 7
yes.
at Grigg Hall. This kind of coincides with this concern over the bird flu in China.
It does. So very important and interesting, using bioinformatics to map these infectious diseases in the same way that we'd look at a weather map mm-hmm. and be able to tell about the spread of weather. We can use that and a technique to map the spread of these diseases.
The mission of the North Carolina Science Festival is to showcase science and technology and to highlight the educational, cultural, and financial impact of science in the state. What is that impact?
That is a great question. It's a growing impact. I couldn't give you an exact number, but it's in terms of dollars, it's obviously in the millions and millions of dollars. But we want to see the workforce grow. So we're working with the community colleges and universities on innovative education programs. And we also want to see the citizenry just become more positive in terms of their attitudes about science. So we're doing things like a statewide poll with Elon University to get at what our public attitudes are about science. And like you asked about controversy and controversial topics, we've found that scientists are eager to engage with people and mm-hmm. answer questions from the general public. Mm-hmm. And we've also found that the elected officials are interested too. So we like to get those folks together and have them discuss these topics just so that they can answer questions.
This is taking place in a lot of different venues, from Discovery Place to the Knight Theater to the university campus. and you can get information about where all these events are, when they are, where they'll be taking place at ncsciencefestival.org. ncsciencefestival.org. And, of course, here at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Jonathan Frederick, the director of the North Carolina Science Festival, and Catherine Qualtro, observatory director and lab manager at UNC Charlotte. Thanks.
Thank you.